fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining me. Now, I don't know if you guys are big fans of, you know, Broadway musicals. I like them. I dig musicals. And are you fans of the musical Hamilton? You know this one. Here's a little clip. Lin-Manuel Miranda and his blockbuster musical Hamilton, which is came out in 2015, and now it's, of course, streaming on Disney Plus. And based on a recommendation from our good friend Lucas Holt, who produces the show, Lucas and his wife Gina really dug this musical. They were just totally into it, and Lucas recommended it to me, so me and Trish finally got around to watching it a little while ago. Loved it, loved it. However, I only got to the intermission. My time, I don't know, man. I'm getting old. I'm so tired at the end of the day. I crash and I just couldn't finish it. It's kind of late.
Don't feel bad, Cale.
Why not?
It was hard for me too.
Oh, really?
So,
oh,
and you've seen it was in color.
Are you guys kidding me? Are you guys kidding me right now? Neither of you made it through
yet.
Oh,
yet.
There's just too many choices out there.
Now, I was
into it. I needed subtitles. I needed backstory. I need to go back and study my history. I'm ashamed.
Yeah.
Because I grew up in Virginia, and I should know it better.
You should.
It is interesting, though.
Should be more patriotic, Karen. But
I'll
tell you
what.
Don't
feel bad,
Cale. I'm a Canadian, and I know more about this. No, I'm only kidding. But I will say this.
That hurts.
Ooh, that's a shot. But having said that, no, I was actually really enjoying it. I was totally enjoying it. And I've been meaning to watch the second half. So I don't know what happens to Alexander Hamilton in the end, so don't blow it for me. But here's why I mentioned this today, because there's an article over at The Pillar written by Mary Farrow about the fact that, and a lot of people don't know this, a lot of Catholics don't know this, that Alexander Hamilton, not the guy from the Broadway show, but the actual founding father of the United States, Alexander Hamilton was actually really good friends with a canonized saint of the Catholic Church. And I'm going to ask you to guess who it is, the crew of the Cale Clark Show. And I'll give you one hint. I'll give you a couple hints. Number one, she's a lady. And number two, her nickname was Wild Betsy, which I think is an awesome nickname.
I have a guess, though, Cale. When you said Wild Betsy, I don't know if I have it, but can I give a guess?
You can make the guess. Yeah.
Elizabeth Ann Seton?
You got it. This is like Jeopardy. Yeah. For 500,
yes.
Alex, I'll take Catholic
Patrick
Saints in America.
Is our Jeopardy.
Patrick's our Jeopardy champion. So, yes, it was St. Elizabeth Ann Seton. And, of course, she is the first native-born American saint. Now, the Setons, now, I don't know if you know this, but Elizabeth Ann Seton, St. Elizabeth Seton, was, in fact, married, had a family, had children. A lot of people don't know that. But the Seton family is not actually in the musical Hamilton. However, in real life, the Setons and the Hamiltons were neighbors. They hung out with each other. They worshiped together at the same church. They would socialize. They ran in the same kind of circles. And they also actually worked on charitable projects together in the community. So this is really interesting. So this article on The Pillar interviews Catherine O'Donnell. Now, Catherine O'Donnell is a history professor at Arizona State University, and she actually wrote a biography of St. Elizabeth Seton. And the two families were actually really well matched to be friends. They had very similar levels of education. This is a case of birds of a feather flock together, similar education levels, similar social status. They were also, both families were of Scottish descent. And you know what they say, if it's not Scottish, it's, you know what. So St. Elizabeth Seton's legacy, by the way, as the first American native-born saint, is being showcased this year. I don't know if you've been to the National Shrine of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton in Emmitsburg, Maryland, but this is the 200th anniversary of her death, which would be, of course, her heavenly birthday. So there are lots of events, lots of things planned at the Shrine of St. Elizabeth Ann Seton. So if you live in the area, or even if you don't, you might want to make a bit of a pilgrimage this year. But let me just tell you a little bit about St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, if you don't know much about her. And I really didn't either, to be perfectly honest. So she's someone that I need to learn much more about. And I was happy to read this because it really fleshed out some things for me. So she was born in 1774 to a colonial family in New York. And her dad, and her future. By the way, her actual maiden name was Bailey. Elizabeth Ann Bailey was her name. And her father, Mr. Bailey, and her future father-in-law, Mr. Seton, they were both supporters of the British, oddly enough, during the Revolutionary War. But afterwards, after everything, you know, went down the way it went down, they did become key players in building up the United States. Now, Elizabeth's father, his name was Dr. Richard Bailey. He was actually the health officer of New York City for a while. And that's how he kind of got to know Alexander Hamilton. St. Elizabeth Seton actually called Hamilton and another guy that was sort of running in these circles, the founding father, Governor Morris, men of superior sense and great brilliancy of wit. I don't know if the original Alexander Hamilton had witty raps like we see in the Broadway musical, but he was a very witty guy. He was a very witty guy. And actually, Dr. Bailey actually wrote a letter to his daughter Elizabeth and said this, and I quote, "I esteem it a high good fortune to be on a footing of communication of feeling and sentiment with these guys." So he was really taken with Alexander Hamilton. Oh, so Mr. Seton, her future father-in-law, he worked for the Bank of New York, which was founded by, guess who? Alexander Hamilton. Elizabeth's future husband, who was William Seton Jr., also worked at this bank, which was owned by or founded by Alexander Hamilton. So Elizabeth married William Seton in 1794, and they lived on a particular street, which is very famous to you. You would know it in New York City. It's called Wall Street. Yep. They lived on Wall Street, and that was really the stomping grounds, as Catherine O'Donnell explains, of Alexander Hamilton. In fact, Hamilton and his family lived on the same street. And so they got to know each other. The Setons and the Hamiltons both went to Trinity Church, which was an Episcopalian church on Wall Street. Now, the Episcopalian church, of course, is what they call the Anglican church in the United States. So a lot of very prominent New York socialites attended that church as well at the time. And Elizabeth Seton and Eliza Hamilton, Alexander's wife, they actually probably bonded together because they were both way more religious than their husbands were. Alexander, his faith would kind of, you know, it'd be up and down throughout his life. He really respected religion, thought it was a pillar of society. He actually requested to receive communion on his deathbed. Of course, this would have been the Anglican form of communion, so not the body and blood of Christ, but he did desire communion. So Elizabeth Seton and Eliza Hamilton also connected a lot socially through charitable work. They worked on behalf of widows and single mothers. And what's kind of interesting about this is that both of them did become widows eventually. And I just mentioned that I have not seen the end of the play Hamilton, but I think I may have just given away the ending to myself about what happens to Alexander.
Spoiler alert.
Anyways, Elizabeth Ann Seton and Eliza Hamilton were women of privilege, but they also were very vulnerable people. They came to see vulnerability to try to help those who are vulnerable, and they themselves became vulnerable as widows and single moms as well. So they did create this organization to help other women. And in fact, there was an orphanage that was later founded in Alexander Hamilton's honor, and it's still out there today. It's called called Graham Wyndham. Graham Wyndham. It's not what it was called back in the day, but it still exists today, this orphanage. So I mentioned that they both became widows, the wife of Alexander Hamilton and Elizabeth Ann Seton. And the untimely death of their husbands was very obviously difficult for them to deal with, but this indirectly led to Elizabeth embracing Catholicism, and here's how it happened. So William Seton was very, very sick with tuberculosis, and in 1803, Elizabeth, William, and their oldest daughter, whose name was Anna Maria, they went to Italy, and really what they were trying to do was, in a sense, seek out experimental treatment for tuberculosis, which was obviously very deadly at the time. And they went to Italy, and they had to quarantine, very much like modern days. They quarantined for 2 weeks, but unfortunately, 2 weeks after that, William died, And he obviously the treatment was not successful, and he died in Italy. So at that point, Elizabeth Seton was 29 years old. She was bankrupt. She became bankrupt, and she was a single mother to five children. Now, these Italian friends that they had, they wasted no time trying to convert Elizabeth to Catholicism after the death of her husband. And they tried to comfort her, obviously, but they, and she actually wrote about this apparently in her diary, Elizabeth Seton. She said, there's some line in her diary where she says, oh, these charitable Romans, they're not going to let a minute go by without trying to convert me. And and she had become more interested in religion herself in the days, you know, before her husband took ill. In fact, there was a new pastor that came to this Episcopalian church, Trinity Church, that the Hamiltons went to and that Elizabeth Ann Seton went to. And this charismatic preacher kind of got her interested a little bit more in her faith. He was a great preacher, very charismatic, as I said. So she became interested in the liturgy, and she started thinking about what does it mean to have a personal relationship with God, an experience of that. And so she made a bit of an inner shift from being somebody who just went to church because it was the good social thing to do. This is what, quote-unquote, good people did in society. They went to church on Sundays. And it became more of a passion for her. And so she started going to daily mass. Her Italian friends, as she's grieving the loss of her husband, started inviting her to go to daily mass, and she went. And Catherine O'Donnell, this religious scholar, this historian from Arizona State University, says, quote, to her surprise, Elizabeth finds herself reacting not just as a tourist, but somebody who's actually moved by Catholicism. She's moved by the figure of the Virgin Mary, who is obviously much more important in Catholicism than in the kind of Protestantism that she had known. She loves the art of the Catholic Church. She loves the culture, the saints, the idea of the intercession of the saints, and she loves the Mass. Little could she know at this point that she herself would be a canonized saint one day and be in stained glass windows and statues would be made of her. But she didn't convert right away. In fact, she went back to New York in 1804 with her daughter. And there was a lot of pressure from her family to drop this idea of becoming Catholic. It's ridiculous. Obviously, in the America at that time, Catholicism was viewed with a high degree of suspicion. And in some quarters, it still is, of course. And before John F. Kennedy became president back in the 1960s, there was still a great deal of anti-Catholicism in the culture. And he faced that a lot in his presidential campaign. But here's what happens. She comes back to America, still thinking about the church. Her relatives are saying, no, don't do that. That's ridiculous. Within a month of her getting back to the U.S., Alexander Hamilton is shot and killed in a duel with Aaron Burr. So is there any point in me watching the rest of Hamilton? Of course there is. The music is great. The tunes are great.
Just to say you did it. Yeah.
But anyway, so now I know what happened to him. But that's okay, so the suspense is gone, but I can still enjoy the music. And Elizabeth actually heard about his death because bells were tolling throughout the streets of New York. Businesses were ordered to be closed for the day. And she recorded it in her diary as a quote-unquote melancholy event, the circumstances of which are really too bad to even think of. So anyway, she eventually does convert to Catholicism, obviously, in 1805, despite all of the efforts of her family and friends to keep her as an Anglican. And as for her family, Catherine O'Donnell, the scholar, says she thinks they're often unfairly portrayed as being anti-Catholic. Actually, what they really wanted her to do is to get married again. They wanted her to find and marry a rich Protestant guy, and fast. And they wanted to just, you know, they were looking out for her. They wanted her to be well taken care of. They were somewhat anti-Catholic in their outlook, but, and really, they're like a lot of people in culture today. They were uncomfortable with the idea of evangelization, somebody trying to get somebody to convert to another faith. And so, really, they're concerned about her financial well-being, the well-being of the children. But Seton, for her own, you know, in her own mind, Elizabeth Ann Seton, she ultimately became Catholic because she could not reason her way out of it. She couldn't reason her way out of it. And she almost looked at it like Pascal's wager. And this is interesting because I thought of this as I was reading the article. And then Catherine O'Donnell, the historian, actually says this. So it was kind of interesting. She said, quote, it's almost like a version of Pascal's wager. the Catholics are kind of more terrifying with the consequences of getting this wrong. But she also feels this pull to Catholicism, and so she decides, whatever the consequences, she's going to convert, end of quote. So for those of you who are listening, you might not know what Pascal's Wager is. Blaise Pascal, great thinker in the history of the church, a mathematician. One of the things that he said was, this is with respect to belief in God. If I say that there's a God, and you say there isn't a God, I say there is a God, and the consequences of rejecting God in this life are an eternity separated from him in hell. But if you accept God, if you follow him, you can achieve forgiveness of sins, everlasting life in heaven. Well, if you're wrong and I'm right, after we die, you lose and I get everything. However, if we're both wrong, really, it doesn't really matter at the end of the day. If we're both wrong about God, then we're both, you know, in bad shape anyways. But if I'm right, I get everything. So the wager is, you might as well just, even if you weren't quite sure about it 100%, you might as well believe, because the consequences, if you're wrong, if you don't believe, are pretty bad. I don't know if I explained that well, but that could also be applied to the church in a sense. And I've always thought this, and I've said this to my Protestant friends, because a lot of them look at the Catholic Church as just another denomination, just the same as any other. Now, most these days, it's extremely rare. It used to be pretty common back in the old days, but it's pretty rare now to find anybody who will say that Catholics aren't real Christians. Most Protestants will admit, yes, they're real Christians. There's a lot of cooperation now between evangelicals and Catholics in the culture wars. So I say to these guys, these friends of mine who are evangelicals, and I was an evangelical for many years, so I know how they think. If you guys think that this is just another Christian denomination, then why not just join it? Because if it's just in case, because if it really is what it claims to be, if the Catholic Church really is the church founded by Jesus Christ that he wants all Christians to be a part of, and if you know that the Catholic Church is the church, now obviously they don't know this, otherwise they'd be Catholic, but if it's got all these gifts for you from Christ, and if it really is the true church, if you join it, well, and it turns out to be, which we think it is, then you gain everything. But if you don't, you kind of lose, right? I mean, you've got nothing to lose. If it's just another denomination, you've got nothing to lose by joining it. But if it is what it claims to be, then you've gained everything. You've gained so much more than what you had before. You've got the full meal deal of the Christian faith now. You've got the sacraments, the true body and blood of Christ in the Eucharist. You've got the teachings of the church. You've got the intercession of the saints. You've got the Mass. You've got confession, forgiveness of sins. You've got all this stuff that the Bible plus so much more. And so I've used a version of Pascal's Wager to talk to my friends about this. And I don't know if I explained that well, but having said that.
Cale. That's,
yeah.
A question from Karen. Mm. What do you think the resistance is to that argument? In my mind, I don't understand what that means, you know. But it's okay mm-hmm. to not understand it. It's a mystery, right? What do you think is the hesitation? I mean, it's a solid argument.
I think there are some hesitations. Obviously, when I ask my friends about this, you know, what would make you not? Why wouldn't you become Catholic? Obviously, the Virgin Mary comes up, the Marian teachings. A lot of guys and gals, they just don't get it. They just don't understand the emphasis on Mary. So that needs to be explained as well. To some extent, the Eucharist, the papacy. Now, the Eucharist is interesting because it's one doctrine that it's rarely disbelieved on biblical grounds, but it's often disbelieved because it seems too good to be true. Like, if it really is true, that's amazing. Christ is literally in the tabernacle down at the end of my street. Wow. I can actually receive him and be united with him. Wow. Amazing.
You know, what for me is I've been a Catholic my whole life, and these mysteries keep revealing themselves to me. So it's not as if Catholics, well, I don't know. And from my Catholic point of view, the more I embrace it, the more it becomes real. So it's like, maybe that's what's so great about being born into the Catholic faith, is that it really does sort of get through to you over your lifetime. And maybe making the choice to jump in is a harder one. But my mother converted from Southern Baptist to Catholicism.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, this is kind of a big jump. But I think for her, it's the same thing. So maybe it was her newness, her discovery, her new eyes on the faith that helped me have that perspective. But I heard once a lovely religious sister say, before she converted, she would go to adoration, and she was not sure if that was Jesus. But she prayed, "If that is you, please help me to understand that it is you." And I think that's like, that's just so like natural. Like, we don't have to understand it all. It's a mystery. It's beautiful.
That's right. Absolutely. And we can know that it's true, but we'll never get to the bottom of it.
Not have to know the facts about it. Right. Yes.
Exactly. And that's when we Catholics talk about mysteries, we're not talking about an unsolvable puzzle like a Sherlock Holmes adventure. It's
just
simply a truth
unknowable.
That's so deep we'll never get to the bottom of it. And it makes sense. We'll be right back on the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. If you're on the phones, hold on. We'll be right back. We'll get to you. Are you tired of educational options that are one size fits all? Our sponsor, Colby Academy, offers the flexibility of both accredited online and traditional school at-home options to fit the needs of your child. Visit relevantradio.com/Colby.
Explaining the faith so you can explain it to others. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Hey, welcome back to the program. It's the feast day of an honest-to-goodness, native-born American saint, Saint Elizabeth Ann Seton. We talked about her before the break. My thanks to Karen Moran for joining me for that segment. The connections between the Setons and Alexander Hamilton, the real guy, not just the musical guy, Lin-Manuel Miranda. What a fun segment that was. If you want to react to that, you can call in right now. 888-914-9149 is the toll-free studio line to talk to me. 888-914-9149. You can also email the program. Suggestions for show topics, always welcome. Comments, questions, Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. And you can always, of course, follow me on Twitter, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And the show account is at Cale Clark Show, which is really run by producer Lucas because he was banned from Twitter some months ago, but you can find him on Gab and Parler. Is it Parler or Parlay? It's just, no one uses that anymore. I think it's gone now. I think there's another one, another alternative that's been servicing. I think it's called Gitter. Anyways.
As in Gitter Done?
Gitter Done, man. but I'm not going to go on that. It's just, you know. I'll wait till I get kicked off Twitter, I suppose. But anyways, that is a list of coordinates for you to get in touch with us. But again, that phone number, 888-914-9149. Now, I want to say this. And Roy, I see you there on the line. I'm going to get to you in just a second. Great, great topic that you want to talk about. But I have to tell people that today is a little bit of trivia for you. Today is National Trivia Day. I bet you didn't know that. That in itself might be a trivial fact to you. Every January 4th, we celebrate people who accumulate and hoard tidbits of useless information. But I don't hoard it. I like to share it with the world. And you might ask the question, like, where did this come from? National Trivia Day. Why is today National Trivia Day? We're going to play some Bible trivia, which we have not done on this program in quite some time. A lot of you have been clamoring for this. So we are going to test your trivia skills in just a moment, but I want to tell you where this came from. Now, in ancient times, I don't know if you know this, but in ancient times, the term trivia was actually regarded to mean something very, very new. Okay, now we don't think of it that way anymore. Back in the 1960s, there were some college students who started writing some trivia columns. Columbia University students Ed Goodgold and Dan Karlinski created the very first intercollegiate quiz bowls. You know, you've heard of the Super Bowl. Well, they were quiz bowls. And they tested all kinds of what some people called useless information. But students really got on board with this. They started calling them trivia contests. And they later published a book called Trivia in 1966, which was the first book of its kind looking at trivia in this revolutionary new sense. It was new at the time, but now it's kind of been, you know, it's kind of commonplace to us right now. It was actually a New York Times bestseller. So we all remember, not all of us are old enough to remember this, but the board game Trivial Pursuit was at its height of popularity in 1984. I was a whiz when I was a kid at Trivial Pursuit. And later on, I talked before the break about being in Protestant ministry. When I was a Protestant preacher, I used to have this great preacher's line, which I, of course, stole from someone else. All preachers steal stuff from other people. And I used to say, you know, for some people, Trivial Pursuit isn't just a game. It's a lifestyle. Amen. Can I get an amen from the back? You know, oh, that's deep, you know. But anyways, Trivial Pursuit, the board game, it was a lot of fun. I really, really loved it. And in terms of this National Trivia Day, how did this day come to be? Well, this was established by Robert L. Birch, who his company is called Puns Corps. I guess he has a company dedicated to producing puns. I want to get involved with this company. I want to buy stock in this company. So he founded National Trivia Day. The first celebration took place as early as 1980. And that was actually just a year before Trivial Pursuit made its debut as a board game. So we're going to do some Bible trivia for you. And we will start off with, could I have some music, please, Lucas? Thank you so much. And you can call in. Now, here's how we're going to do it. We're going to ask the first three questions, all right? So when you call in, just tell me whether you're going to answer question number one, question number two, or question number three. Try not to cheat. Try not to use Dr. Google. And see if you can do this on your own wits. Keep the playing field level and fair. No performance-enhancing drugs either. All right, so question number one on National Trivia Day, some Bible trivia here on the Cale Clark Show. Here's the first question. It's something I've wondered a lot. Did Hezekiah himself author the book of Hezekiah? Okay, that's your first question. Did he personally write the book of Hezekiah? All right, so that's question number one. Question number two. Who was the first person mentioned in the Bible as laughing? Who was the first person who laughed according to the Bible? That's question number two. And question number three, and I sincerely hope someone knows the answer to this question because I have a great, great story to tell about this one. Question number three, what is the name of the only person in the Bible mentioned as being bald, specifically mentioned as being bald? What is the name of the only person mentioned in the Bible as being bald, bald-headed? That's question number three. So if you know the answer to any of those questions on National Trivia Day, you can call in right now for some Bible trivia on the Cale Clark Show. We will tweet your name out. You will live for all eternity on Twitter as long as Twitter still exists. 1-888-914-9149 is the number to call. And we are going to go to Roy. We're going to go to the phones right now. While those calls are coming in for trivia, we have another call coming in from Roy in Lexington, Kentucky. Hello, Roy. You're on the air.
Well, hello, Cale. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You got it.
I enjoyed your segment. I'm sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say, it's great to get a call from the Bluegrass State of Kentucky. So,
thank you. Thank you very much. Yes. I actually live in Louisville, but I work in Lexington. And so I am at work and when I spend the night in Lexington, I listen to Relevant Radio. We don't have a station in Louisville yet, but I'm going to work on Father Rocky as much as I possibly can to see if we can't get one.
We got to make that happen. We got to make that happen, Roy.
Oh, absolutely. We've got to, you know, Louisville and the surroundings is about 1.7 million folks. So we really could use a station. Very, very Catholic town, by the way, too. But all right. I appreciate I loved what you were talking about. I converted from being a Southern Baptist about 5 years ago to Catholicism. And I'm, of course, I feel totally at home and I'm thrilled to death and I'm happy that I landed where I landed. But I was listening to your discussion about the evangelicals, and what I really think, sir, if you'll forgive me, is I think that when one has a robust religious discussion with an evangelical, I think that they have to grudgingly admit that Well, it may be, at least in your case, you're probably a Christian. But I don't know that they see the whole denomination that way, even still. You know what I mean?
That's interesting.
And that's right. And I think because I think they think, you know, there are a lot of Catholics that aren't scriptural. There are a lot of Catholics that are somehow sort of like many of my Jewish friends accuse other Jews of being. It's just basically, just ethnically kind of following the ritual, but not really putting a lot of faith in it. That mm-hmm. kind of thing. And so I think they still think of us as being a little dangerous. And if you really think about it, we're terribly dangerous, because if you admit that we're Christian, then there's no argument against Catholicism whatsoever.
If you truly admit, right?
If we're Christian and we've been Christian for 2,000 years, you know, then all of the things that you know cause the various denominations to split from one another, they all sort of become kind of meaningless, you know.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
admittedly, you know, and I always say this, you know, admittedly, you know, the Presbyterians have things that the Baptists don't like, and the Baptists have things that the Methodists don't like, but they all tend to have more in common than at least they think they do, than with the Catholics. But I think they would simply have to be defensive in this situation if they were to really think about this. They wouldn't be able to do anything but convert.
Yeah, Roy, then I think that's where my argument that I was making before the break kind of comes into play, because if you do admit that Catholics are Christian, then the Pascal's wager argument with respect to, if you do think that's just another denomination, then why not join it? Because just in case it isn't, just in case it's more than that, which we obviously believe that it is. And yeah, I appreciate the call very much, Roy. That's really, really good stuff. And please call back anytime. That was Roy from Lexington, Kentucky. That's a really good point. I loved how he said, "We Catholics are dangerous." It kind of reminds me of a line from one of my favorite movies, Top Gun, when Iceman is like, "You're dangerous." And Mav says, "That's right, Iceman, I am dangerous. And we Catholics are dangerous. The truth is dangerous." So don't get too close. No. We want you to get close. We want you to embrace the faith. Absolutely. So we got some trivia questions coming in now. Some answers to the trivia questions, hopefully, coming in. So we had, of course, our Bible trivia round, our lightning round, and I've got some more questions, too. So if we get these ones answered, we might have some time for some more. But we're going to go to Sam, our good buddy Sam, calling from Athens, Georgia. Hello, Sam. Good to talk to you.
Hello, Cale.
Happy New Year.
Same to you. Happy New Year.
Well, I'm glad you're back, Sam. And so you got an answer for me for one of these questions? Now, which one was it? Question number one, question number two, or question number three?
The one about the bald head. That was Elisha. And the kids making fun of him were eaten by a bear.
Yeah, that is correct. That is correct. So do we have some prize-winning music, Lucas? No, that's disappointing. My goodness. All right, so we need to have some fireworks or something going off for you, Sam, but you are absolutely correct. That was question number three. What was the name of the only person mentioned in the Bible as being bald-headed? You were right. It's the prophet Elisha, 2 Kings chapter 2, verses 22 and 23. And I have a really, really great story about that, Sam, so I am so happy that you answered that question. I'm gonna tell that at the end, because it's so good. I just have to share this with everybody. I love it. But we got to get back to, we still have two questions that we need to get answered for now. So let's go to Roxanne, who is calling in Northern California. Hello, Roxanne.
Hello. This is my first time actually getting through. So
you got
I'm
through.
Really happy.
That's a victory in itself. So congratulations, Roxanne. And which question? Now, we just had question number three answered. I'm hoping that you'll have one or two.
I had the answer for all three of them, but unless you don't want me to answer two of them.
Well, I'll tell you what. Just pick number one or number two, okay? So question number one.
I'll take the question about who laughed, and that was Sarah.
That is correct. That is correct. Very good, Roxanne. And that was question number two. Who was the first person mentioned in the Bible as laughing? And that, of course, was Sarah, the wife of Abraham, when God says, you're going to have a kid in your old age. And she's like, yeah, very funny, God. And that is in Genesis chapter 18, verses 12 and 13. So very well done, Roxanne. Really appreciate that. You got through. Call back anytime. And we got one more question left to answer in this little package of questions here. So let's see. Now, do we know, Patrick? Hopefully we've got somebody who's got question number one. We don't want any repeat answers here. That's not going to be too entertaining. So who should I go to next? You can whisper in my ear. We're going to go to Chris in Chino Hills, California. Hello, Chris.
Hey, Kale. How are you? Love your show.
Well, thank you, sir.
But you know, I had an answer. Actually, I was going to guess a number two, but I was wrong. I was going to guess Isaac. You know, it's like, so there you go. And the only other point I have now, what was question number one again?
So question number one was, did Hezekiah himself actually author the book of Hezekiah?
Okay, so this is a 50-50 chance, right?
I wouldn't say that.
I'll say that. No, you wouldn't say that. Okay. No,
you'll see why. I feel kind of bad about this.
I'll say no. No,
well,
that's okay.
You know what? Actually, that is the right answer. That is the right answer. Because you know what, Chris?
Okay.
I have to confess. Chris, you got it right, man. That's great. But I got to confess. Yay, Chris. Chris, I appreciate that. Chris, call anytime. Chris from Chino Hills, California. Sounds like he's in his car. I must admit, I was being a little bit naughty here. The question was a bit of a trick question. Did Hezekiah author the book of Hezekiah? There is no book of Hezekiah. So I'm sorry. I've used that one before. I couldn't resist pulling that one out again. It's been a while since I used that one. But yeah, there's no book of Hezekiah. It's a trick question. So if you really know your Bible, you would have known that that wasn't the case. All right, we're going to take a quick break right now on the Cale Clark Show. We will be right back. 888-914-9149. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Faith, facts, and fun. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back to the program. It's the final segment of the day, show number two of 2022 for the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 888-914-9149. We just had an incredible lightning round of Bible trivia. It's hashtag National Trivia Day. And earlier in the program, we talked about the saint of the day, St. Elizabeth Ann Seton, and her connections, her really cool connections to Alexander Hamilton, one of the founding fathers of the United States, subject to the musical Hamilton, which is pretty awesome, even though I kind of found out about the ending before it happened. I found out about what happened to Hamilton, and but it didn't spoil it for me. Still awesome. Got to check it out. And yeah, so if you missed that, please check the podcast. It'll be up about an hour after the show ends. You can listen to it wherever you get your podcasts, or on relevantradio.com or the Relevant Radio app. Now, I did promise I had a great story about one of our trivia questions, which was answered very correctly by Sam in Athens, a great friend of Relevant Radio, very faithful listener to the program. And the question was, what was the name of the only man mentioned in the Bible as being bald-headed? Lots of bald-headed people, no doubt, but only one is specifically mentioned as being bald, and that was Elisha, the prophet Elisha. And Sam correctly answered that question. And I got a great, great, little bit of background on that one for you, and I think it's great. My friend, Professor Jason Staples, Doc Staples, was a great professor at the University of North Carolina at Raleigh, has a great blog post about this from a little while back. And this is a biblical story that people just scratch their head at and say, what in the world is happening here? So let me just tell you about this passage and what the big deal was and whether Elisha's baldness had anything to do with what happened. So this is from 2 Kings chapter 2, verses 23 and 24. It says, "And Elisha went up from there to Bethel. While he was on his way, young juveniles came out from the city and mocked him, saying, 'Go up, bald head, go up, bald head.' When he turned back and saw them, he cursed them in the name of Yahweh. Then two female bears came out from the forest and mauled 42 of those juveniles. This is one of those passages that make people say, what the what? What is going on here? My goodness. And by the way, I didn't even include this passage because there's only so much time in the program. But tomorrow on the Faith Explained program, you're not going to want to miss this, 12:30 Central on Relevant Radio. Mark your calendars. I'm going to be talking about a question that I get a lot. I'm sure you get it too. Why is there so much violence in the Old Testament? Is God a God of violence during the Old Testament time, a God of genocide? What's with all the seemingly arbitrary violence and all the killing? How can I believe in this God? Is this the same God as the God of Jesus Christ in the New Testament? Well, answers to all those questions, tune in tomorrow, 12:30 Central, right after the Mass on Relevant Radio. Check it out, and you can get the podcast later if you can't listen live. But I didn't even talk about this passage. But this is one of the passages that people bring up when they ask about seemingly senseless violence in the Old Testament. This idea that these young guys were making fun of the prophet Elisha, and he curses them, and these she-bears come out of the woods and maul 42 of them. What? Okay, what's the background here? All right. This is, by the way, who were these guys that were, they're making fun of Elisha? It's a notoriously difficult passage to translate. Jason Staples translates it as young juveniles. But the word could mean young man, it could mean servant, could mean, it's used of warriors at some point in the Old Testament. Very often soldiers are young men. It's kind of hard to know. But let's use juveniles. Let's go with what Jason says. They're basically young punks, young whippersnappers. And anyways, this is very disturbing to a lot of people. Why would a prophet of God call down curses upon a bunch of kids for making fun of him because he's bald? Go up, baldy. Go up, baldy. That's it. That's it. You know, you're done. I'm going to curse you, and God's going to send the bears to maul you. All right. How do we explain this? Well, first of all, this is not Elisha being mad that people are making fun of him for male pattern baldness, okay? First of all, Elisha himself is pretty young at this point. He's probably not going bald naturally. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But Elisha was, remember, his mentor, of course, was the prophet Elijah. And Elijah's been assumed into heaven in a chariot of fire. So Elisha takes up his mantle. He's the new prophet in town. So Elisha himself is still pretty young at this point. He lives for 60 years after this event through the reign of five different kings. So he's not some, like, you know, doddering old guy or anything like that. And, you know, not the case at all. Probably in all likelihood, he had shaved his head because of a vow that he had made to God. We know about this. There's examples of this in the Bible. St. Paul in the New Testament, at one point he shaves his head. And it talks about this in the Acts of the Apostles because he's made a vow. All right, well, we don't do that anymore. But some people also say, and Staples points this out, that calling somebody a baldy or, you know, bald head was kind of a pejorative reference to people who were lepers, other types of outcasts in Israelite society who had to shave their heads, sort of as a means of identification. Hey, I'm a leper. Don't come near me. Don't want you to be unclean. But the baldness has nothing to do with why Elisha cursed these young guys and why they were mauled to death, 42 of them, by a bear. Here's the problem. The young people from the town of Bethel are rejecting the prophet of God, who is Elisha. And by rejecting his prophet, they're rejecting God himself. It's kind of like when Jesus said about the apostles, hey, if they reject you, they're basically rejecting me because I sent you. So they tell him, what are they telling him? They say, go up, baldy, go up, baldy. That's not exactly a term of endearment. Basically, it's the same words that are used to describe Elijah, the mentor of Elisha, going to heaven in a chariot of fire. He went up. So they're saying to Elisha, why don't you go too? Why doesn't God just zap you up to heaven, get you away from us? We don't need to hear your preaching. We don't want to hear about this God. And that's part of the thing. So not insignificant, by the way, that this happens in the town of Bethel, just outside of Bethel. Bethel was one of the hot spots of idolatry in the Old Testament times. Dan was another place that was known for this. Bethel had a golden calf, if you can believe that, set up by Jeroboam after the kingdoms divided north and south. And by the way, earlier in the book of 1 Kings, chapter 13, there's a young prophet, we don't know his name, he cursed the altar of Bethel and its priests. And Jeroboam, you know, basically stuck out his arm saying, go get that guy. And when he did that, his arm withered. It just shriveled up. So this is a generation after that. And after the time of Elisha, Bethel again would prove to be a pretty controversial place where the prophet Amos, declares his famous prophecy against Israel, which we have in the book of Amos. Anyways, there's a bad curse there in that book where Amos curses the priest of Bethel, Amaziah, and this is what he says to him. He says, thus says Yahweh, your wife will become a whore in the city. Your sons and daughters will fall by the sword. Your land will be divided up by a measuring line, and you yourself will die upon unclean soil. Wow, that's in Amos chapter 7. That's pretty harsh. That's pretty harsh. So here's the thing also, how many people were actually there? This is actually a pretty dangerous situation for the prophet Elisha, because as Jason Staples points out, usually when a couple of large wild bears run out of the woods and start tearing people to shreds, people tend to run, and they run pretty fast, pretty quickly. They get out of there. They hightail it out of there. So think about this. If two bears maul 42 people in this crowd, how big was this crowd? Because you'd have to assume most people were running away. So this was probably more than just 42 young people there. This was a huge public protest rally against the prophet Elisha and against Elisha's God. So this is a dangerous, dangerous situation for the prophet. The youth of Bethel were absolutely rejecting Yahweh. And that's why they're being so hostile to the prophet. And that's what leads Elisha to curse them. So, wow, that is pretty wild. Now, by the way, this was exactly what was prophesied in the book of Leviticus. If you are unfaithful to the covenant, there's all these, we tend to focus on the covenant blessings in the Old Testament. If you keep the covenant, all these great things are going to happen. But don't forget, there's also covenant curses. If you break the covenant, some bad dealings can ensue. And here's what it says in Leviticus chapter 26. It says, if you act with hostility and are unwilling to hear and obey me, I will send the wild beasts among you and bereave you of your children. Wow. That is exactly what happens in this situation with Elisha. If you act with hostility, they're being hostile towards them, and you're unwilling to hear and obey me, I will send the wild beasts among you, bereave you of your children. Who dies? These young guys. We don't know exactly how old they were, probably older teenagers or maybe in their early 20s, whatever. But this is what's going on here. These people are unfaithful to the covenant. They're rejecting God. And that's why Elisha curses them. And some people use this passage as, hey, how could God allow this to happen? Isn't this a sign that the God of the Old Testament is some sort of an angry God who can't be trusted? How dare God kill anyone? Well, as Doc Staples says, a rather high percentage of people do die at some point. It's just a question of when God allows this to happen. And obviously when it comes to young people, this can be a bit of a problem. More so than with the old philosophically, but if you accept the fact that God is a judge and he can judge when it's the best time for somebody to go, there's really no issue here. So this is really part of the process of Israel falling down, this downward spiral towards the fact that God Israel itself became disobedient. So much so that, hey, God's not playing favorites here. Even when the Israelites disobeyed the covenant, they were punished by God. And the biggest punishment that we can think of that happened after this point was the Babylonian exile, when God allows King Nebuchadnezzar to invade Jerusalem, carry off the Israelites, including Daniel and his buddies. We talked about Daniel on the Faith Explained program. and led them into exile, which was a catastrophe for the nation. So I didn't even deal with that when we looked at these passages about the violence in the Old Testament. So we'll talk about that and how to sort of think about that a little bit on tomorrow's episode of The Faith Explained at 12:30 Central. But it did have something to do with our trivia question today. Well, it's been an incredible episode of the Cale Clark Show. Now, we did have an off-air caller who asked a quick question from Texas. I wasn't able to stay on the line. And the person asked, could I go to confession from far away? I have COVID right now. Well, I guess it depends how far. a priest might be comfortable, maybe a few feet away, as long as I can hear your confession and nobody else can hear it. It could be possible, but the sacrament of confession needs to be done in person. So if you're not able to do it in person, what you can do is make an act of contrition. God is able to forgive, of course, outside the sacrament. Just do your best. Trust God. Trust in his mercy. Don't worry. And the next time you can go to confession after you recover, Lord willing, go to confession and mention those things. So that's all we have time for right now. But we'll be back tomorrow. Lucas Holt produced. Patrick Alog took your calls. Really want to thank Karen Moran for joining me earlier. And it's been a slice on the Cale Clark Show. Take care.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.